We have a very special guest with us today in the studio. The New York Times Magazine once called him America's most prominent Marxist economist. And for the past few decades, and I mean decades, he's toured the U.S. talking to Americans, teaching them about a thing called capitalism and why it's going to fail. He's written or co-authored over a dozen books on Marxist thought and economics and hosts an hour-long radio program called Economic Update through Pacifica. Most recently, he founded a project called Democracy at Work, which advocates for democratic workplaces as a key part of a transition from capitalism to a new and better economy. Welcome to the studio, Richard.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, you know, I had a really hard time prepping for this interview because I was, you know, I could ask you about anything. And I was going to email you and ask you what you wanted to talk about, but then I thought about it and I was like, well, there's a couple of things that I really... they're burning in my heart. So
good. Let's do those.
We're going to talk about those. But first, we're going to talk about something that's less burning in my heart, Trump and his taxes, because it just happened. I want to ask you about it. What are your thoughts on Trump and his taxes?
Every wealthy individual that I have ever encountered in my life, and because I went to the elite schools in the United States as a college kid, I've encountered quite a few. Every one of them either takes advantage of the tax laws himself or herself, or more usually pays a lot of money to a tax accountant who does it for him or her. So I am not surprised, shocked, or any of the other things that Mr. Trump has done like they all do. That he gets caught at it, that he finds himself in some embarrassment having done this. That's maybe bad luck for the fellow, but you look almost anywhere and you will find this is the norm. And the folks at the upper end of the income distribution, the infamous 1%, long ago understood that there are two wings to their tax strategy. The first one is to pay the lobbyists to make the laws written in such a way that they can minimize their tax burden. And then whatever is left of the tax burden, they can evade in a whole host of ways that either are legal or start getting semi-illegal or are altogether illegal. And the tax accountants are there to help them navigate this complexity and get their taxes down real low. So I understand it's good PR as part of an election campaign, but the truth of it is this has been going on a very long time, and barring a big change in America, the wealthy have figured out how to stay wealthy pretty well.
Right, and you sort of touched on something that I've been struggling with and that's interesting to me. You know, recently we found out about corporations hiding money offshore. Right. It was supposed to be a big deal. News broke, and it kind of felt like it wasn't a big deal. People just said, well, shocker.
I mean, let's do the numbers. The estimate of the amount of money that is being held outside the United States by major corporations, depending on how you count, is in the $2 to $3 to $4 trillion range. Okay, if you take the rough estimate of 35%, tax on that, you do the arithmetic, you're talking hundreds of billions of dollars, which would enable the government, if it got that money, to do all the things it currently tells us it can't do. This is outrageous. This violates the spirit of everything. But I think we can't expect the mass of our fellow citizens to be outraged yet again by another outrage of this sort. They see it everywhere. They encounter it in their lives. And so they've become, as you put it, kind of shrugging their shoulders and saying, what's new?
Right. I think what's interesting to me about that is that the sort of extraordinary things that happen in capitalism are just everyday things.
Yeah, they're routinized. That's right. It's one of the ways you make them acceptable. It's simply too much emotional effort to get all upset about.
Well, and so this gets to my burning question, really. So we started with Trump and we get to the burning question. And I'm not even really sure how to phrase this, but because we don't have a lot of time, I was just like, just get to that point, which is that, you know, in the past, you're a Marxist economist.
Right.
And in the past, Marxism was the foundation of a lot of uprising. It was the basis. A lot of uprising. People studied Marxism. The Panthers studied Marxism. Mm-hmm. That's kind of gone. You know, so we've had Bernie Sanders as a sort of socialist. with a lot of popularity, but people have kind of lost the imagination to think of a future without capitalism. What is that future that we're going towards?
Well, I think that the phenomena you're drawing attention to, that it becomes routinized, that we kind of shut down our sensitivity to each outrage that the system hurls at us, let's put it that way. That does happen over and over again in history, but it also disappears over and over in history. In other words, people become resensitized. Something happens, and suddenly the outrage that made them shrink back once upon a time, but then stop shrinking back, just accept as normal, once again becomes unbearable, outrageous. And I think it's always been a mystery what that is. Some people think, and I think they're wrong about it, but they think, well, if conditions get bad enough for
people,
you
hear that a lot.
Then they'll do it. And there's something to that, obviously. But I don't think it's only that, because then you'd have a hard time explaining why people who have been in really terrible shape for a long time become used to that, too. I think it's more likely a complicated mixture of conditions getting bad, for sure, but also glimmers of a sense of possibility. Because if you have a sense of possibility, then you can allow yourself to see it again, to be outraged. It's almost as though a feeling of outrage is a luxury we give ourselves, but we only give it to ourselves if there's a way to actualize our anger, to imagine at least that it could be better, that it could be different. That's, I think, where Bernie comes in. I think he's a very important phenomenon on that road, because he showed for the first time in half a century in the United States that a politician could say, oh, yes, I'm a socialist, and it wouldn't have been, as it would have in the past, instant political suicide. It wasn't. He said it. It stood there. Everybody took a deep breath, and then it didn't matter anymore. The routine of dismissing a socialist as out of order was replaced by the routine that being a socialist is perfectly okay. Because if Bernie's kind of socialism is okay, how do we know that a more robust version, a more challenging to capitalism version of socialism, might not next month, next year, prove to be just as interesting to the American people as the more moderate version? He broke the taboo. And I think everybody on the left owes Bernie Sanders, whether you agree with his particular proposals or not, we all owe him a doffing of our caps to say, whoa, you opened a space in which all kinds of other ideas, including those Bernie might not himself like, now have a chance to get an audience and to be entertained by people who before would have been afraid to go down that road.
I think the other time, personally, that I've had that glimmer of hope where the outrage comes out more because I can see something else is organizing. Black Lives Matter and Occupy, these movements are places that people create together a sort of prefigurative society, something else, something new, and they talk about it. People don't necessarily have access to those organizing spaces anymore. And I wonder if that has affected the way that we think about the future.
Well, everything I just said about Bernie, I would have said also about Occupy. I'll go even further. I don't think Bernie was possible without what Occupy had done. Just like Black Lives Matter has its debts as an upsurge movement now to both Occupy and Bernie. That's what I meant before. This is a process that you let the genie out of the bottle, you can't get that genie back in that bottle. Things are underway. And look at Black Lives Matter. When major athletes in the country, having felt these things, see Black Lives Matter, well, then getting down on one knee in front of the television cameras becomes a powerful political act. It's not that this athlete didn't know about all these things before, like you have said in this conversation. It became routinized. But Black Lives Matter said, no, it doesn't have to be a routine. We can push back against all of these things and maybe change it. That is very powerful. When bad conditions combine with the notion maybe we could together change it, that's political dynamite. So yes, of course, every organizing effort, even those that technically, quote unquote, fail to achieve their objective, that's always a mistake to call them failures, because the very process of trying is powerful, regardless. I mean, it's always better to win than to lose in these things. But the very process is something that transforms people's lives as individuals. Nothing makes an organizer become that for his or her life than doing it once, getting caught up in it once. You kind of realize for the rest of your life that you were never quite as alive as you were in those hectic moments in the basement of the church trying to figure out a strategy for doing something, and you kind of have a yen to do it again. In other words, you become the organizer kind of person who makes things happen. That's why it is so important to welcome, to celebrate, to nurture, almost like it was a little flower, every time human beings get together to make something better, to try to figure out a strategy. Nobody knows the best strategy. Nobody knows it. Let me give you an example of that, because so many are tempted to imagine that in a book or in a movement, they figured out the right way to go. Don't do that. That's terribly destructive. And let me give the example. I live in Manhattan. I live a walk from Zuccotti Park, where Occupy Wall Street kind of was born. And I remember thinking to myself, if the folks who had set up the tents in Zuccotti Park had come to see me 3 or 4 months before — they didn't, but let's hypothetically had they come — and they would have said to me, hey, we'd like your response. Our plan is to set up a bunch of tents in a little park downtown in Manhattan to see if we could really spark a movement. I would have been very calm and very sympathetic and would have said to them, I don't think that will work. You will, you know, no one cares. You set up a tent. They'll maybe let you stay there a few days, and then the police will come and roust you out of there, and everyone will think it's weird and strange and of no interest. I'm so glad they never came to talk to me. I'm so glad they never asked my advice, because the advice I would have given them would be stone cold wrong. Who could imagine that at that moment a few tents in a park would lead within weeks to 300 cities across America doing that, to people getting excited in a way they haven't for decades about social change? I mean, had we had the inkling that that would have worked, of course we would have all done that, but we didn't. And I think that's a wonderful way to remember. There's a certain humility. The most important thing is that people get together and want to change. How they do it, what they decide to do, sure, make some choices. You know, you can't do everything, so you choose, and that's important. But it's way less important than that first gut-level commitment. I am not going to take it anymore. I'm going to try to do something together with other people, because I'm smart enough to know that by myself I'll never be able to transform all of this. So for me, it's a new day in the United States. I am very optimistic, and that's despite thinking that our economic system is in terrible shape. We can talk about that and why that is, and nor am I alone. I can assure you that many of my colleagues on the right, in the center, and on the left are very anxious, especially now that we're about to head into another economic downturn. And given that we haven't really got out of the last one that hit in 2008, what a downturn later this year or into 2017, what that might mean, nobody knows. Europe is in terrible shape. Japan in terrible shape. The United States, very flubby. That's why the Federal Reserve dare not raise interest rates, because we're so close to disaster already. That despite all of that, I'm optimistic, because Occupy, Bernie, Black Lives Matter, that's an extraordinary upsurge of collective action to change society. Not in every case to exactly what I would do, but who cares? It's much more important that this is underway than that we have kind of empty debates about the best way forward. We don't know. The truth of it is, the more of us that try, the more we'll discover that this works really well right now, and this one doesn't. And you know, to explain that, that's for historians. In the next 50 years, we'll be looking back. They're already doing it. Why did the 60s happen, right? There's 20,000 books and articles trying to figure out. We didn't know it at the time, and we're still trying to figure it out. And that'll be true of Occupy, and that'll be true of Bernie, and that'll be true of Black Lives Matter. Let's not get hung up on that. It's very interesting. We can learn from those historical studies. But once again, the key issue is to recognize that the vast majority of people are losers in the current capitalist system. That's very hard to face. Who wants to face being a loser, especially in our country? But that's the reality. And there's now movement to change it. That's a wonderful combination. Before, we had losers but no movement. Now we have losers with a movement. That makes all the difference.
And the movement is really what makes this time bearable, because I'm sure you feel this as well. But as a journalist, when you're reading things like we've passed, what is it, this new threshold for carbon emissions, now right. We're headed through to another type of climate change that's even worse, and that all fish are going to die off. And, you know, Europe is collapsing and becoming more and more xenophobic. Look, watching what's unraveling in Syria, I mean, all of it starts to make you feel pretty pessimistic.
Grim.
Yeah, pretty grim. And you do wonder, this is about as bad as it gets. What is it going to take? If capitalism was ever going to be overthrown, it feels like it should have happened.
Well, let me be the economist for a minute and add a little bit. Not wanting to depress anybody, but to add a little bit. You know, I love to repeat to people that the Oxfam, that British outfit that issues reports on world poverty, which, by the way, everybody takes seriously. They're the most respected source of this kind of work. They issued their annual report, which I read every year. And so this year, for 2016, they made the calculation that the 62 richest individuals, 62, you know, they could fit into the rooms that I'm sitting in with you in now. 62 individuals together, the richest, most of whom are Americans, not all, but most of whom are Americans, together own more wealth than the bottom half of the population of this planet, which is 3.5 billion people. Now, let me give you a second statistic, very similar, but to give you a sense. There's something called billionairecensus.com. I'm just mentioning it, so if people want to check it out, they can. That keeps track of billionaires, is what they do. And so it turns out we have about 2,500 billionaires in the world today, 2,500 people who own $1 billion worth of stuff or more. And again, the biggest single bunch of them in terms of wealth are Americans, but there are plenty of other Europeans are the largest in number and so on. And the billionaire census did a little calculation. It said if we put all these people together, imagine a hypothetical fantasy country populated only by these 2,500 people with their wealth. It would be the third richest country on the planet. It's the wealth of those 2,500 together is exceeded only by the wealth of the United States and People's Republic of China, because they're the two biggest economic units now. That's unbelievable to me as an economist, that capitalism is a system that has made 2,500 people have, by the way, roughly $7.7 trillion worth of wealth. If you took away half of the wealth of these 2,500 people, it would give you $3.5 trillion, roughly, maybe a bit more, which is way more wealth than is going to be given to Asia, Africa, and Latin America by the UN, by the foreign aid of every country that gives them foreign aid. In other words, we could transform the lives of billions of people and still leave these 2,500 folks to be the richest in the world, because half of what they have still leaves them. There is no excuse for that. What conceivable ethical, moral, or religious commitments that any listener right now has could possibly justify giving 2,500 people the kind of wealth which would transform the lives of the vast majority. Would mean they wouldn't die of starvation and hunger. They wouldn't get all these illnesses, which we know how to cure. They would get the education that would enable them to transform their own life. Everything we want to happen, we could have. Still leave these obscenely wealthy people obscenely wealthy, and we don't do it.
Why is it that we don't do it? I mean, it just seems so simple. I remember talking to a woman who was a prison rights activist, a prison abolitionist, actually, and she was like, if you invested a third of this money into communities, a third.
You wouldn't have the folks in the situation in the first place. Sure.
And you would fix the communities that have been torn apart by the incarceration system. And it was just a simple solution. But that's never going to happen.
Well, I think it is.
You think it is?
Yeah. And let me use a historical example. If you ask yourself, why did the Roman Empire fall apart? It was the most powerful thing the world had ever seen. It had the wealth. It had the military strength. It had everything. And by the way, you can ask the same question about the Greek empires and about the British Empire. I mean, you can go on and on and on. When you look back, you know what strikes you? They didn't seem to see it coming. They had lost any self-control. They were out grabbing and reaching and gathering until they produced their own gravediggers. They produced their own enemies on a scale which you can't quite grasp as you look back. How could they be so blind? How could they be so stupid? Why weren't they satisfied with what they already had? Why did they keep having to do it more until they provoked their worst nightmare? My reaction is, good, because that means that's where we are. We are at a point in which obscene wealth is out of control, becoming more so. I mean, I'm sitting here in San Francisco, having looked in the weeks before I came here at the statistics about real estate values in this city. They're off the chart. It's a kind of craziness that's going on. We have that, by the way, in New York City and in other parts of the country, too. It's not just here. But it is a sign of going too far. It's almost as if the system itself, at some secret level, knows it's over and is, if you allow me, grabbing it before it all disappears, holding on, grasping the last little bit before what the French call the denouement, the unraveling of the whole situation. And I think the signs like Occupy, Bernie, Black Lives Matter, and growing movements that we don't hear so much about because they don't make it into the mass media the way those did.
And international ones, too.
Absolutely.
The other interesting thing about these sorts of times, and we've seen this in the past as well, is the critique of capitalism can also come from the right, and it can also take the form of fascism.
Yes.
And racism and xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiments.
That we used to call that scapegoating. If the society is falling apart and there's a criticism of the system of capitalism, then you want, if a person doesn't want this to proceed, you want to give people something else to be angry about, not the system. And then there are, again, classic targets for that. Women. I'm using America as an example. I could give the parallel in other countries. Women, African Americans, immigrants. I mean, it's really standard what you're doing here. You're trying to make some case with a little bit of evidence that you can drag up to get people angry at something else so that they can vent their dissatisfaction with a system that isn't working for them anymore on something other than the system itself, which is why so much of the work I do is devoted to making the best case I know how that the problem is the system, to give support to that part of every person that knows that, that feels that, that senses that. Even if that person is tempted to be angry at an immigrant, to be angry at a Washington bureaucrat. In this country, the biggest ideological support is to get everybody angry at the government, as if the government is some sort of independent actor in the story, which it never was and isn't today. It is really remarkable for me as an economist to watch in the history of the United States workers who are, for example, laid off of a job. They're unemployed. And they lost their job at a factory, an office, a store, whatever it is. And they're angry at a politician. My first reaction is, it wasn't the politician that laid you off, John, Mary. It was a private capitalist who told you one Friday afternoon, don't come back here Monday morning, you're fired. Or all the people in America who over the last, 10 years now, have lost, estimates, 5-6 million people lost their homes, were deprived of their homes. And they get angry at the politicians. And my same question, it wasn't the politician that took your house. It was a banker, a banking capitalist. But it's the genius of America, more than many countries, to have so created an ideological culture that people upset by the behavior of private capitalists don't blame them, leap right over them and get angry at the politician. If I were a leading capitalist, I'd be giggling all the way to the bank about this. You kick the workers and they're angry at somebody else. You kick them harder, they're more angry at somebody else. You're free. That has to be dealt with. People have to get back into their vocabularies and into their understanding that they're part of an economic system and that there are people in that system whose logical position leads them to do things that are bad for you. Even if they don't mean you any harm, who cares? The harm is done, and that's a problem. Could you have a system that worked differently, that was governed by different priorities? And the answer is yes. But before you can have that conversation, they of our fellow citizens, they have to understand that there's a system here, and that the system that we have may not be the best one. And I can assure you, as somebody who now travels all over the country talking like this, not just on the radio, but as I move around, that the openness of the American people to this idea, I have never seen anything in my lifetime, and I have white hair. So I can tell you this, we are at a moment in American history that we haven't seen pretty much 60 years. That's a long time. And at this point, things are possible to be discussed that haven't been for a long time. People are open. And that makes me very optimistic. I am constantly pushing the envelope of what can be said publicly. No pushback. Hmm. No pushback. It's not that people all agree with me, not at all. But that this is a conversation that they will enter into. That they will listen to a systematic way of thinking, a systematic critique. There's no question that that's going on. And that's why I also appeal to everyone listening. Now is the time to talk to your spouse, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your sister, your cousin, your coworker, your neighbor, because they're ready to listen. Even if they don't seem that way at first, they're ready to listen. They're suffering very similarly to you. They're seeing bits of it. Nothing will help them face it more strongly than hearing you sound off about it.
And I know that we're running out of time, but I had a lot more questions for
Please.
You. And I wanted to talk about democracy at work, but I'm not sure if we're going to have time. I think what I would want to talk about in relation to that is you believe that there is a crisis in capitalism happening and that things will change.
Yes.
And that there are certain practices that will help us transition.
Yes.
Can you explain briefly what those practices are and why they're important?
Let me try to do it historically, since for me that's the best way it works. Capitalism is roughly 300 years old as the kind of dominant system of the world. And indeed, over the last 300 years, it has become more and more dominant until it's literally now a global phenomenon. But it is important to remember that 300 years is not a very long time historically. That before capitalism was dominant, completely different systems were. For example, in Europe, feudalism. In other parts of the world, feudalism too, slavery, and so on. There were other systems that were completely different. For example, in slavery, there's no wages. Nobody pays anybody any wages. Nobody earns a profit. It doesn't work like that. A slave is one person is a property of another person. It's a completely different economic system, has its own rules, its own dynamic, etc. Feudalism, again, nobody hires anybody to do anything. That's not the system. It's serfs and lords. It's a whole alternative arrangement. Well, once you're aware of that, you know that every system that the world has ever seen, wherever it has become localized or real, has been born, has evolved over time, and has died. That's why we don't have mass slavery in the world anymore. That's why we don't have mass feudalism in the world anymore. The notion that capitalism is the system that is born, evolves over time, and then there's no death. Of course there's death. It's very hard to face death, yes. But systems die too. And in fact, once you understand it, it becomes a necessary question to wonder, is this system dying? Is it destroying itself the way the others did? And if so, what does that mean? Who is making that happen? How is that working? For me, it's always a question. How healthy is this system? How close to its own self-destruction might it be? That has to be faced for me, since I believe all systems come and go. And so it leads me to a line of questions that follow. For example, what would an alternative system look like? What can we expect? What might we try to achieve? Well, now let's do the history again. What's unique about slavery is the relationships among people as they went about producing things. You know, in a slave economy, people produced food, clothing, shelter, buildings, all the things we do now with their own technology. But the interesting relationship was between the people who directed the process and the people who did the work. The ones who did the work were the property, like an animal or a piece of land, of those who directed it, master, slave. When that disappeared, it was replaced by lord and serf. The serf is not owned by the lord. It's not slavery. We give it a different name because it's a different relationship. The lord and the serf entered into a kind of religiously sanctioned relationship. You are a lower order person. You're a serf. And I am a lord. The very words tell you the name of the game here. Now, what's capitalism? Capitalism is an arrangement where there's, again, a small group of people calling the shots, but they're not masters. And they're not lords, because they don't relate to the people that do the work as property, as in slavery, or as subordinate people, as in serfdom. What is going on? Well, it's an interesting thing. It's a deal. It's a contract. I will come to work for you 5 days a week, 9 to 5, and at the end of the week, you give me money, and then I'll come back next week, and I'll do all this again. I give you the fruits of my labor, my brains, my muscles. I work in whatever way you tell me, producing whatever you tell me to produce, with whatever raw materials you provide, whatever machines you make available to me. You tell me what to do. I am complete at your service, sir. And at the end of the week, I go home at the end of every day. I leave behind what I produced, what my brains and muscles helped to produce, a haircut, a ham sandwich, a software program, whatever it is, because it belongs to you. And you will get the fruits of my labor as long as you give me a paycheck at the end of the week. Okay, that's capitalism. And if that's the system that has gotten to the point we're at now, a situation of obscene inequality of wealth, which we've talked about, a system whose instability is mind-bending. Let me remind everybody, we are now working our way through the second collapse of capitalism on a global scale in 75 years, which is historically no time at all. In the 1930s, we had a catastrophic depression. And we're now in the Great Recession, having replaced the word depression with recession, because we hope it won't be as bad as that first one. And if you allow me to be the economist, between the end of the Great Depression, roughly 1941, and the time this current one hit, 2008, there were 11 more economic downturns. I'll make this joke that I always make at this point. If you lived with a roommate as unstable as capitalism, you would have moved out long ago or required him or her to get professional help. We live with a system whose instability threatens us all the time, with all the kinds of problems that unemployment and insecure jobs represent for people. So we're with a system that is unequal and unstable. What would an alternative be? Well, I think the kind of whole history of the human race tells us the alternative. And the alternative is make a break with what all three of the old systems have in common. In slavery, a tiny number of people are masters, and they control and tell the majority, the slaves, what to do. In feudalism, a tiny number of people are lords, and they tell the mass of people, serfs, what to do. In capitalism, a tiny number of people are super rich capitalists, and they tell everybody else what to do. Literally, in every capitalist enterprise, a board of directors, 15 people on average, tell the employees, could be hundreds, could be thousands, could be tens of thousands, what to do. Every one of these systems has something fundamentally alike. A tiny number of people are telling a mass of people what to do. It is the opposite of democracy. The whole idea of democracy, slowly nurtured over centuries now, is if you are affected by a decision, you're entitled to participate in making that decision. And anything other than that is undemocratic, if not autocratic. A capitalist enterprise is the definition of no democracy. Not only is capitalism not a means for democracy, it's an obstacle to it, because it says the production of all the goods and services we need as a people, upon which we depend, literally, for the food we eat, the clothes that keep us warm, and all the rest, we're going to organize that in a grossly undemocratic way, having a tiny number of people telling you what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits your labor helped to produce. You accept that? The answer to the question, where are we going, is we're going where we've been tending to go for centuries.
Right,
we're finally bringing democracy to the workplace.
So we're hopefully not going to create another system in which a couple of people tell everybody else what to do.
Right. And the way we're going to prevent that from happening is finally to recognize you can wish for that till you're blue in the face. But if you don't create at the base of society, in the daily life of working people, a democratic institution there, how can you imagine it's going to exist in the neighborhood where you live, in the government that you erect? Of course we don't have real democracy in our politics, in our communities, because we have created at the base of our society, in our economy, a screamingly undemocratic way of doing things. We wonder, for example, why more people don't participate in politics, at least, you know, learn about the election, learn about the parties, learn about the candidates. Because they spend all day of their working lives in a situation where no one gives a damn about their point of view. No one asks their opinion about anything. They have absolutely no say about what is happening in the workplace. And they should suddenly, on leaving the place where they work, 5 out of 7 days, their adult life, suddenly develop democratic appetites? You've suppressed their democratic appetites where they work. At the very least, since I can't be sure of anything, I would say this. If you want democracy anywhere in society, you've got to institute it in the economic foundation. And if you don't, you're not serious about democracy. You're speaking about it, but there's no real commitment at all. Capitalism is a system that never permitted, never countenanced for 5 minutes a democratic workplace. And that is why the system produces the outcomes you and I and people like us deplore. Are we really surprised that an economic system in which a tiny number of people make all the decisions ends up making a pattern of decisions that enriches them at everybody else's expense? Why are we surprised? Of course the people who make the decisions think about themselves first. The system is set up. You can't even blame them. They're caught up in this same system the way the rest of us are, and are acting out, in a sense, the assigned role. Change the system. Say that in every enterprise, that's why I celebrate worker co-ops, in every enterprise, everybody who works there, together, one person, one vote, makes the decisions. We bring democracy to the workplace because we want that kind of a society. If you tell me that gee, if we did that, it might not be as efficient producing goods and services. I will do two things. One, I will show you all the research that indicates, in fact, the opposite, that when workers have a real stake in an enterprise because they own and operate it collectively, they care more about whether there's a faucet running after 5 o'clock that shouldn't be, that the light is turned off because it's their enterprise. But even if I give you that, let's say they were 5, 10% less efficient, wouldn't that make a society that was democratic? Wouldn't that be a good price to pay for such a society that distributed? Look, we would never distribute the fruits of our labor so that 2,500 billionaires have $7 trillion. If the mass of people democratically decided how to distribute the fruits of an enterprise, they'd never do it that way. They'd never give five people obscene amounts of money while everybody else can't pay for the kid to go to college. Would not happen. You want to deal with inequality. Worker cooperative is the way to go. But now let me play a little game with you as a conclusion. The fact that I have been able, in the last, whatever it is, half an hour or 40 minutes, to talk the way I had just been talking, that's the best evidence that this system is over. Because we see it. It's when we couldn't see it that the problem existed.
When we didn't know how to ask the questions yet.
That we didn't know how to frame the questions. We didn't know how to put it together. More and more of us are now able to do it. And that's the best sign that the system is coming into a period, which, by the way, can last a long time. I don't want to give anyone any illusions. I don't know where we are. I know that capitalism has, there's no reason to assume that capitalism, unlike every system that preceded it, will last forever. That's a delusion that everybody had. The people in slavery believed it would last forever. It didn't. The people in feudalism thought it would last forever. It didn't. It's about time for us to grow up and realize the delusion some of us have that it will last forever, that there is no alternative, what they used to say. Tina, the old joker from Margaret Thatcher in England. That's silly. Of course we're going to die. When that happens, how it happens, I don't know, and no one else does either. But I think it's a very powerful sign that there are now movements of large numbers of people that are willing to say, capitalism is the problem. Capitalism is a system we don't think is successful for us. Capitalism is a system we need to put behind us, like we did slavery, like we did feudalism, in order to do something better. One of the new political parties in Germany, just about a dozen years old, is called Die Linke, which in German means the left. So it is a party that is part of the parliament in Germany. It gets, I think these days, 8 or 9% of the vote in Germany, which is important. 1 out of 12 Germans votes for it. They just got 15% a couple weeks ago in the vote in Berlin, the capital city. So that's 1 out of 7 German citizens of Berlin voted for it. Here's one of the slogans of the party, the Die Linke, translated into English. Germany can do better than capitalism. When you have a party that is as successful as they are, granted they have a long way to go, they're still getting 8 to 15% of the vote, but nonetheless, these are straws in the wind, just the way did the success of Syriza as a new political formation in Greece, or the Podemos in Spain. You're seeing more and more of a sense of people that capitalism as a system has had a free pass for a while, that the old challenges represented by the Soviet Union and People's Republic of China, those have not worked out real well. They do not provide a model for most of us. They did important things. They had real achievements. It's not that. But as a model for a new and different society, no. That centralized planning, that government owning means of production, whatever the virtues of that, this didn't usher in the new society that its leaders had promised. And there again, we end up with the conclusion, well, what was missing? What did they not do that caused them not even to survive, let alone achieve the goal? And again, my answer would be they didn't transform the workplace. They didn't dare because they weren't ready yet to say, What we have to do is make the workplace itself a democratic institute. We have to dare to give the working people the ownership and control directly of their working lives. And my guess is if you put together what they achieved and you overcome what they failed to do, you might have a dynamite combination for a new world in the 21st century. And if I were asked, what is 21st century socialism? It's 20th century socialism with the radical addition of worker, enterprise, workplace-based democracy, which they did not dare to try in the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China. On almost as if to give you a concrete sense of people grasping this idea, the biggest change in Cuba over the last 5 years has been the decision to move away from state-run enterprises and move more into cooperative private enterprises in which groups of workers collectively own and operate their enterprise. I think that's a very, very important experiment in exactly the direction of all the things we've been discussing.
Oh, I think that's a great place to end. Thank you so much for joining us, Richard.
Thank you again for the opportunity.